a song that almost made last week's set list of drinking songs. It's The Replacements. Here Comes a Regular by request here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Also in that set of music, Johnny and Santo, or Santo and Johnny, depends on which way you want to give them their billing, did an updated version of their hit, Sleepwalk. Played the Ink Spots in there, pulled out the 78s for this one. With When the Swallows Return to Capistrano, because today is actually the day that they leave Capistrano. Apparently they leave on a very specific day, and it's today. So if you're in the area, don't stop by tomorrow, because they'll be gone. And start off the entire set with something from Galaxy 500, doing George Harrison's Isn't It a Pity, which was released on this day, the George Harrison version, as his very first single post-Beatles in 1970. Wow. I amaze myself. The following is a message for those fortunate enough to care for a person who has always been their hero. Growing up, your hero was always there. They repaired your first broken heart. They took care of you when you got sick. And they sent you into each chapter of your life with advice and lessons that left you feeling ready to conquer the world. But with the passing of time, the tables have turned, and your hero now needs you more than ever. AARP is here to help care for your hero. Find the care guides you need to help complete. Oh, I'm sorry. To help with complete with tips. That's what it is. I was going to help you complete something, but no. With help, complete with tips and resources at aarp.org/caregiving. Message brought to you by ARP, the Ad Council, and the Mockster. Hey, it's, I don't know, it's sometime after midnight. No, it's not. It's after 9. I'm just pushing to the midnight hour already. Sometime after 9 here on the Viva La Mock radio program. As I mentioned, that Replacements was a request. Someone went to the old interwebs and emailed me a request last week and said, "Hey, Mockster, welcome back. Glad you're on the air. We've been listening every Friday, and you haven't been on the air, but we've really dug the mix of music. Maybe even better when you're not on the air. Hint, hint." No, they actually didn't say any of that. But loyal listeners, and I appreciate you listening. Always, you can send me a request for a future show at wrctrequest@gmail.com. And yes, welcome back.
Hi, Mrs. Johnson. Is Paul gay?
No, Johnny. Paul's not gay.
Hi, Mrs. Johnson. Is Paul in rehab?
No, Johnny. Paul's on dope.
Hey, Mrs. Johnson, is Paul on fire?
Yes, Johnny, Paul is on fire.
Hi, Mrs. Johnson. Is Paul dead?
Yes, Johnny. Paul is dead.
Shove from the right. It's all planned out. We'll do it tonight.
Push the president and his wife. Hoping for ransom or take their lives.
shoots are put behind bars. Good day, sir! Good day, sir!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Aubriana Bench, and I'm joined by my oldest brother, Andrew Bench. Today we'll be looking at a smaller borough located a few miles north of Pittsburgh called Westview Borough. Andrew and I both grew up in Westview, and being history nerds, have learned quite a bit about it. But I wanted to bring Andrew today because he has some special experience with the borough. So, Andrew, I already introduced you, but go ahead and tell us what you do right now.
Well, right now I work for the Allegheny County Health Department doing clerical work. But before I was at the county, I worked for Westview Borough for about 6 years. And while I was at Westview, I was an administrative assistant, but I was also their archivist. So one of the things that I did was I was tasked with digitizing Westview's archives. And it's a pretty small borough in terms of size, but over 100 and something years, you generate a lot of paperwork. And legally, the borough, and any municipality for that matter, has to keep certain documents, and they wanted to have a copy of them digitally in case something ever were to happen. So through that work, I became well acquainted with Westview's history, and I even started giving presentations at my alma mater, or our alma mater, North Hills High School. I give local history presentations from time to time. Very passionate about Pittsburgh history in general.
So let's go to the beginning of Westview. How far back does it go? Do we go to the 1700s or like...
Well, I mean, you can't tell the history of any place in America without first acknowledging the fact that we're all on land that once was used by Native Americans. So prior to any European settlement, there were many Native American tribes that were living in what is now Pittsburgh. As European settlers started to arrive, and as they pushed farther west, this forced a lot of Native American tribes into this area in particular. This was called the Ohio Country in the 1700s, and it was considered the frontier. Pittsburgh was at the westernmost part of the frontier. And so Westview's history goes back to that. There's a guy by the name of Caspar Real who in the 1790s, I believe it was 1795, he was given land for his service in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. And that land is the bulk of what Westview is today. So he was given this land, and at first he couldn't use it because there were the threat of Native American attacks. Eventually, after the Battle of Fallen Timbers in Toledo, Ohio today, it pushed the Native Americans out of the Ohio country, and he was able to settle, and he built a log cabin, which is still there in Westview. It is one of the oldest structures in southwestern Pennsylvania. It's actually a residential property to this day. It was turned into a weird house, hybrid cabin thing. You know what I'm talking about. You've seen it. So that's where Westview's history really starts, with Caspar Real. Eventually what happens is, in the early 1800s, a group of settlers come together and they petition the courts to create Ross Township. Ross Township is partitioned from Pine Township. Pine Township is Wexford today. Ross Township is created, and for 100 years, Westview is just a vague name of an area within Ross Township. It's not until 1905 that a guy by the name of Frederick Martzoff gets the idea to build a community. He was a land developer. He had built houses across the United States, and he came to the Westview area and was so enamored by it that he bought 700 acres and decided to build a community there. And so really, it's Frederick Martzoff, who he's the father of Westview, if you will.
So were this Caspar Real guy and Martzoff alive at the same time, or what's the timeline here?
No, so Caspar Real, he's born in the 1740s.
Oh, so he was old.
So he's a young man fighting in the Revolutionary War, and then he's in his midlife by the time he gets this land that is now Westview. Martzoff is born in the mid-1800s, I want to say 1848. Okay. And he doesn't start building houses in Westview until 1905, and actually, unfortunately, passes away in 1907, so he wasn't around very long to see it. So no, separate time periods altogether.
So was there anything interesting going on between 1795 and the mid-1800s in Westview?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on your definition of interesting. So Westview, the reason that Westview and this whole area, in, for that matter, were settled, part of the reason is obviously Pittsburgh is situated at the merging of the two rivers into the Ohio River, so it's a prime spot for industry. But the reason that the greater northern part of Pittsburgh, the North Hills, even all the way up to Erie, there's a road there that was built by Native Americans. It was a trail called the Venango Trail, And so Westview is situated right on the Venango Trail. It was an existing road that settlers could use, and so that made it very easy for them to leave downtown Pittsburgh and go north. And you could take it all the way up to Erie. There was a fort in Erie, so there were settlements all the way up. In terms of distinct events in the 1800s, that's when the population of Pittsburgh and the surrounding areas starts to go up, but it's not really until after the Civil War that Pittsburgh starts to industrialize. Mm-hmm. In fact, Westview and Ross were mostly farmland until the late 1800s. It was the country.
So the Venango Trail, is it hard to pinpoint when that first started? Because obviously it's still around today.
Yes. We don't know for various reasons, which would be a whole other episode. We don't know a lot about early Native American history, so we don't know when the road was created. We know that they were using it for centuries prior to European settlers arriving. It was probably formed by ancient buffalo herds that were migrating. A lot of Native American trails, they would use trails that they found. So thousands of years ago, there were buffalo in this area that would migrate, and they probably beat that path into the ground over centuries, and then the Native Americans, why wouldn't they use it? It's less work. They don't have to build it. And same with the European settlers. Once they arrive, there's already this trail here that goes all the way up to Lake Erie. In fact, the Venango Trail allowed, they sent supplies up the Venango Trail all the way to Lake Erie, and it actually was part of the reason that Commodore Perry was able to win the Battle of Lake Erie, because they were able to get the supplies up there during the War of 1812. Well, that's something going on in the 1800s.
Well, so now part of this trail is called Perry Highway after this guy.
So we're still using it.
Yeah.
Today. In fact, the Perry Highway that we have, Route 19, whatever you want to call it, it is more or less the same sort of path that the Venango Trail would have been. There are obviously variations. But if you start to research the history of a lot of roads in the area, a lot of them were once trails, because when Europeans arrived, that's what they started using as well. And so a lot of the roads today are where the trails used to be, including Perry Highway.
So circling back to Westview, or going back into that area, let's go back to when the Martzoff guy, you said early 1900s, when was it, when he passed away?
He died in 1907.
Okay. So wasn't it around that time when Westview Park first started or was founded? Mm-hmm. And that was a major thing for Westview, right?
Yeah, Westview Park was actually, it opened in 1906. So it basically existed as long as Westview had. Westview is incorporated in 1905, and then the park opens a year later. So as you can imagine, the park became an integral part of Westview. I mean, for 70 plus years, that was the heart of Westview in terms of business and bringing people in to the area.
So because it was such a critical part of Westview, whenever it started, because you and I both know about when Westview Park started its downfall, but do you want to enlighten listeners on what happened with Westview Park? And
do you just want me to give you an overview?
Give an overview, because there were a lot of parks in the area where this kind of started happening, except for, as a lot of people know, Kennywood, which is still open. But
well, first, I will say I'm not the foremost expert on amusement parks. There is a guy, a Pittsburgh local named Mike Funyak, who wrote a very good book on Westview Park. So anybody who wants a deeper understanding of the park, I would check out his book called It's Westview Park, the T.M. Harton story. But at the turn of the century, the early 1900s, these parks were really popular. There were dozens of them all over. There were many in the Pittsburgh area. They're the most, some of the more notable ones are Westview Park, there's Luna Park, Kennywood. And it's because that's, at the time, that's what people were doing for fun. These parks were, I would argue that they thrived for two reasons. One, you may have heard Kennywood referred to as a picnic park before. It's because it was built on what was a picnic ground. And then the park, they would encourage people to bring your families, bring a picnic, and then go ride things at the park. Westview Park is the same. It started as a picnic park. The land was purchased, and then it became a picnic park where they would encourage families to come, bring food, and then ride things. You also have to remember that early amusement parks, you're not buying a ticket, and then you can ride anything. You're paying per ride. So individual companies would have rides at these parks, and they would collect some of the revenue from people. So they're obviously, these people want to build cool rides, so people come ride their ride. That's the whole thing behind Westview Park. So it's a picnic park. The other important thing is that it's situated at the end of a trolley line. Back in the day, we had a much more robust public transportation system, and you could actually take a trolley from anywhere in the greater Pittsburgh area to Westview Park. It ended right at Westview Park, the trolley line. So anybody could get there, and that was a huge, huge advantage for the park. People could easily get there. When the park's created in 1906, a guy named T.M. Harton, he's the one that creates it. He's already a successful businessman. He manufactures and operates amusement park rides. So he already has a company, and he does so well that he says, shoot, why don't I just make a park and I'll put my own rides in the park? And so that's what he did. He's a Pittsburgh native as well. He picks Westview as the spot for this park. And Westview Park is there from 1906 to 1977. By, you know, within 10, 20 years of Westview Park being created, it's the only park in the area besides Kennywood. So for most of the 1900s, the only two amusement parks in this area in Pittsburgh are Kennywood and Westview Park. And they didn't really compete with each other because they're far enough away from each other that their crowds aren't necessarily picking one over the other. So they existed, you know, just fine with each other.
Is there any reason why Westview kind of started seeing a downfall? Was it 50s or...
60s. So again, if you talk to some of the older residents in Pittsburgh, they'll often, you might hear, oh, well, Westview Park couldn't compete with Kennywood. Not true. They weren't really seeking to steal each other's customers. Westview Park is about 18 acres, but that's it. If you go to the Westview Shopping Center, that's where Westview Park was. It's pretty small. There's not a lot of space to expand. So by the 1940s, they've taken all the available land they possibly can use. I would say their golden era was after World War II. The baby boomer generation is their children at that point. So they are obviously going to the park. So in the 40s and 50s, Westview Park does really well. Starting in the 60s, attendance starts to falter, and honestly, even until they closed, their attendance wasn't bad. It just didn't continue to go up. Part of what happened, they couldn't expand anymore. That meant they couldn't put new rides in to attract potential new visitors. The other thing that happens is in 1973, there's a fire. Westview Park has a dance hall called Danceland, and Danceland was a huge spot where young Pittsburghers would go. A lot of people, older people in Pittsburgh, actually met their spouse at Danceland. It was a big deal. You'd go and listen to live music and dance. Well, that burns down in 1973, and they don't rebuild it. And that was one of the nails in their coffin. They just, as attendance faltered, they weren't able to keep up with the newest innovations, and so the park slowly declined. But even in its final year, 1977, attendance was not bad, but it wasn't great.
Kind of like a
slow decline. It was just a gradual decline, I'd say, from about the mid-60s to 77 when
so
it closed.
So if it had closed any later, it probably would have been slower and lower attendance, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it probably would have become more run down.
Yeah. And so do you think the closing of Westy Park, or like the slow-ish decline, I don't know if it would be a decline because they close it, right, whenever attendance was barely going down.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think it kind of, messed up Westview, or kind of put Westview into a hard spot towards the end of the 20th century?
Well, yes, short answer. There's a couple, I'm an avid Pittsburgh historian. So Pittsburgh becomes a steel manufacturing hub. And up until the 1960s, oh, that's another thing I didn't mention. The population of Pittsburgh in the 50s and 60s is double what it is today. Well, when the late 60s, early 70s come around, a lot of steel jobs are leaving Pittsburgh. And so there is a gradual decline of Pittsburgh's and the surrounding area's population. So Pittsburgh peaked at over 600,000 people. It wasn't until the 2020 census that we actually stopped losing population. We've steadied out at about 330,000, I believe. So we have half of our peak. So you have less people living in the area. Westview is a picnic park, and so people would have school picnics, company picnics, union picnics at the park. Well, less jobs, less steel companies, steel plants, less picnics, less population. And by the time Westview Park closes, the steel industry is almost entirely gone. By the early 80s, Pittsburgh is at one of its lowest points in terms of jobs. And Westview not only has less of a population, but they now lose one of the biggest draws to the borough. The park had existed as long as Westview had existed. And so for that park to suddenly close, the borough kind of has an identity crisis. It's like you're born with your right hand, and then all of a sudden your right hand's gone the next day. That would be pretty bad. I mean, that's kind of how I think of it. They existed together for so long. And so Westview does experience a little bit of a decline in terms of population. And even today, I would argue Westview, I'm biased because I work there and live there, but they do a really good job at maintaining their public services, paving the roads, keeping the parks and the borough looking really nice. I'd say they're exceptional because I've been in a lot of municipalities in Pittsburgh. But the one thing that they've struggled with is getting good local businesses back in the borough. And that's a problem that a lot of municipalities face. How do you attract people to do business in your municipality? And there have been a few new businesses that have opened up in Westview in the past 10 or so years. There's a great Italian restaurant near our house, Severina.
Coffee shop.
There's a new coffee shop that just opened. So there are things happening in Westview. But there was a decline. And I don't think it was Westview's fault. I think it was just the trends of what was happening in the greater Pittsburgh area, coupled with the fact that Westview Park closed. Yeah, I mean, that's going to cause a decline. Right.
What would you like to see in the future of Westview? Do you think there's anything that could fix? I mean, well, maybe it doesn't need to be fixed, but what do you think? Up the population, bring back Westview Park.
Yeah, that would be cool. I don't know that Westview needs to be fixed. I think it's a very nice place to live.
A good place to live.
Their motto is a good place to live. It is. It truly is. I enjoyed growing up there. I enjoyed working there. I think the thing that would help Westview the most is making it an attractive place for people to come to, whether it's restaurants or various businesses that are there, make people want to come to Westview, and also continue maintaining the public services so that new people want to move in. That's the only way you're going to get more people coming in, is keeping it attractive. And I think that they are doing a really good job at that. Westview is certainly a place that I wouldn't mind going back to live in one day. It is pretty small. It's only about a square mile, so that, you know, there's a limited number of houses. But I think those are the two biggest things, is attracting more businesses and continuing to maintain the level of services so that people want to live there. I think, yeah.
Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think would be worth touching on?
Oh, geez. I don't know, like what?
Oh, man. What's one of your favorite things in terms of Westview or Pittsburgh history to talk about?
I talked about it earlier. I find it very interesting how it was settled, why it was settled, the Venango Trail, mm-hmm. people moving north, the early history of Pittsburgh around the French and Indian War, Revolutionary War period is really cool. The Fort Pitt Museum has a really cool exhibition going on where it focuses on the early history of Pittsburgh, in particular conflicts with Native Americans. I find that very interesting. In terms of Pittsburgh in general, I think it's very fascinating how Pittsburgh has gone from a filthy, disgusting, horrible place to live in terms of environmental health, and through the efforts of various figures over the decades, we have turned that around and become more than just a steel city. In fact, Pittsburgh today would be unrecognizable to somebody living during the Gilded Age. There's healthcare here, tech, higher education, like Carnegie Mellon. So the fact that Pittsburgh was able to pivot itself and turn it into something new, you don't always see that with cities. There are still cities that are struggling to get their footing after losing a major industry. You know, take Detroit, for example, or, you know, Cleveland. Pittsburgh is unique in that way. It's unique in a lot of ways, but I think the fact that we've continued to be a cool place to live, it's pretty neat. And I think we're unique in that regard. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What key figures?
The Pittsburgh Renaissance. David L. Lawrence, who was the mayor, and then I believe it was Richard Mellon III. I'm going to have to fact check myself, but those two figures are responsible for reshaping Pittsburgh, literally cleaning up the city. The convention center is named after him for a reason.
Mm.
And then, obviously, the school is named after the Mellon family, so those two figures. I should also mention that I used to work at the Frick, and so I know a lot of... my other interest is Pittsburgh during the Gilded Age. But that's a whole other topic.
I'm doing that topic in my environmental history class right now.
It's very interesting.
I have learned that it might not... There is some... You can put Pittsburgh cleaning up on legislation, but it was actually mostly the cause of natural gas coming into the city. And more Pittsburghers using natural gas to power their homes.
That makes sense.
Instead of coal. Yeah. But anyways, it is short, but is there anything else you want to add before we finish out?
Check out Westview Borough's website, specifically the history section, because yours truly wrote it, and I'm very proud of it, because, you know, 6 years ago when I first started there was not a whole lot, and now you could actually go research it. And one of the highest compliments that I ever received from working at Westview was I got letters from elementary school kids. And they said that they loved the website and they were doing a project on Westview Park, and could I please send them pictures and information? And that was awesome, because that's what it's there for.
Yes.
Not for the glory. My information should be accessible.
Yes.
So yeah, check out Westview's website. There's a lot of really cool photos and things from the archives on their website still.
There are some really cool pictures of Westview Park. During its peak.
It would have been fun.
After, yeah.
I wish I could have experienced it. I'm sorry, not much of a Kennywood guy.
This is Aubriana Bench. I'm interviewing Andrew Bench.
WRCT.
Thank you for coming in, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
I'll see you at home later tonight. All right.
Fine.
Bye.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
RCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It's actually, is it morning? Now it's afternoon. It's officially 12 o'clock here. Welcome. We're in here chatting today with somebody. But before I introduce them, I do want to say that any views expressed today by myself or by my guest are strictly our own and not necessarily those of WRCT. But I'd like to welcome today to our show A good friend of mine, our resident Kiwi here at CMU. This is Grady Kennix. Good morning, Grady.
Good morning, Anthony. How you doing?
There we go. We got you now.
Good morning, Anthony. How you doing?
Oh, I'm fantastic. We have an interesting topic today. For those of you who haven't been keeping up with the news because it's dreadful to open up a newspaper or open up social media because it keeps on getting worse, you know, there was recently a development in which the cost associated with an H-1B visa, which for those of you unfamiliar, the H-1B visa is one of the visas offered to people seeking to immigrate to the United States for high-skilled workers, are people of exceptional talent who come to the United States, are Elon Musks of the world. And the cost associated with that went from $1,000 to $100,000. And this has provoked some responses from people on the left and the right. This will be an interesting conversation because technically we're both on the right, but we have some starkly different views on this kind of development here. But you know, kind of per you know, my courtesy I extend to any guest on this show, I'd like to invite you to kind of, you know, share your reflections first on this, Grady, and kind of tell me what do you think about this?
Oh, me personally? Absolutely. Well, look, I'd have to push back a little bit against the characterization of H-1B as the visa for America's top talent. That's the O-1, and it's for the very best and brightest. That's your Einstein visa, you know? The H-1B visa was initialized as a kind of, you know, slightly lower talent visa. And that it did that job for a very long time. It brought in people like Elon Musk, Melania Trump, just really great people, you know? Came here on H-1B visas. But in recent years, in recent decades, I'd say, fraud has become endemic in the H-1B visa, and the sheer numbers have both risen and skewed towards a very different base of countries than we were previously accustomed to seeing. And as a result, H-1Bs have become less of a tool for getting the best and brightest future taxpayers into America and more of a tool for getting cheap labor, to be as blunt as I possibly can.
Well, I'd like to kind of, you know, hear more from you, because you say kind of like the countries we're looking for or cheap labor. You know, I'm curious, you know, because there is still, you know, a requirement based on skill. You know, sure, we're not talking about necessarily our Einsteins. You kind of mentioned that there's this kind of slightly lower threshold of talent, but you know, this, we're still talking about skilled labor here. I mean, you know, these are the people that, you know, come to our universities, become engineers or computer scientists, and ultimately, you know, seek in many ways to bring those talents to the American labor force and help provide the skilled labor that drives some of these industries that we're looking to excel in right now, particularly AI. And I think you see that footprint, especially here in Pittsburgh and at Carnegie Mellon, where we have a good number of international students that are, you know, seeking to stay here after they complete their studies and will in many ways help us kind of keep the edge in these fields. But I mean, you know, talk to me a little bit more about your kind of thoughts on, you know, what this fraud is, how it's, you know, in your mind, abused.
Oh, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. The people at Carnegie Mellon are the best and the brightest, by any definition of best or brightest. But what's really troubling about the H-1B visa is how this idea of, like, talent and measuring talent can be so quickly abused. We've seen, for example, to give just one example, there's a whole list of criteria you can use to prove your talent, you know? And one of them is judging a hackathon. We all know and love hackathons. We've got some great ones at CMU. And so fraudulent hackathons have sprung up where you don't pay to enter. You pay to judge. And people will submit, like, ChatGPT, Slop, and, well, the judges judge it. And then they put, we judged a hackathon on their, you know, their application, and they send it through. And this is just one of many, many, many ways that these things can be gamed. I'm talking fake diplomas. I'm talking diplomas from online universities or universities that give you 1 week's worth of coursework for a hefty fee in India or China or wherever you are. And then you put that on your application, and look at that. Now you're going for an H-1B, and you have a serious chance of getting it. That's the kind of fraud I'm talking about. And surveys of H-1B applications have shown that just right off the bat, between, I think it was 30 and 40% are just provable fraud, and that's just the ones they could catch immediately from randomly selected samples of H-1B visas. That seems like a problem to me. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of, sure, I mean, we could look at, you know, their reported issues with the program, but it seems like the response has been, instead of saying, you know, we're going to have some more robust ways of checking the validity of some of these things. Because quite frankly, you know, you could even look at, say, something that isn't, you know, a government program, like college admissions generally. The amount of gaming the system that happens in applying for college is immense. We'll put it that way. And, you know, I think, you know, great. You know, we want to make sure that our systems are working the way that they're supposed to. But it seems like kind of this knee-jerk reaction to increase the cost threshold of an H-1B visa has not been to kind of deal with those sort of issues, but rather say, you know, like, we want to make it monetarily more difficult for people to pursue this program. I mean, you know, very often you have people that come from countries where the GDP per capita is abysmal. You know, these people are, quite frankly, coming from countries that are, they're dead ends where their talent would otherwise be completely wasted. You know, very often people will say, you know, like, we have Einsteins all over the world, but some of them are in places where they're either going to, you know, die at the age of 30, or they're, you know, like, they're basically stuck in this dead-end situation. And, you know, that's why the H-1B visa program allows us to not only give them an opportunity, but they give back the opportunity to us to help us nationally excel. You know, and I think this is, you know, why it's so important to look at, you know, in the context of the AI race. You know, so many people, you know, especially in the admin, are saying, we want to be at the forefront of AI development right now. We want to be basically running circles around China, especially. And that's why we had an AI and energy summit here at Carnegie Mellon, where Senator McCormick brought all of these stakeholders together, including the president. But, you know, instrumental in this process is making sure that we have the best and the brightest here. And that means in all of the above approach, which means, you know, sure, we are cultivating our talent at home, but why would we turn away talent that seeks to come to our country and make our country better? And ultimately, and you know, this is something that I kind of had the opportunity to write about for some of my coursework, the idea that, you know, when you have this influx of highly skilled labor, they have high disposable income, and that creates jobs in of itself. And, you know, in our unskilled sector especially, providing, you know, entry-level jobs for native, you know, people that are born in the United States as well. There, you know, it's kind of, I think the problem that's kind of endemic in this kind of debate is the idea that this is all zero sum, when, you know, the zero sum model of the economy is something that's often parroted by people on the left that see capitalism to be this kind of cutthroat, like war, where, you know, whereas, you know, there's trillion-dollar bills, if they existed. Well, actually, no, they do exist, because the Fed has printed them sometimes to justify their kind of ludicrous spending, but we're not getting there. That's a conversation for another day. But there's trillion-dollar bills laying on the sidewalk, and we have to kind of have the kind of knowledge and ability as a country to say, like, hey, we have these opportunities to make, to, you know, have the tide that lifts all boats here. But I've kind of, you know, waded into this water a little bit. Feel free to kind of address any of that you see to be most important.
Oh, no, you're totally right. I mean, this, like, zero-sum thinking is pervasive on the right, and I do think it's wrong. I also think that, like, well, for example, I'm a mathematician, and in math there are these, like, people back in, like, the 50s, 60s that were called the Hungarian aliens, or the Martians, and they were the most talented mathematicians in the world, and we brought them all over from Hungary on O-1 visas, I believe it was, maybe even some H-1Bs in there, and they revolutionized American mathematics. So, yeah, there's definitely a case to make for top talent. Nobody's saying that there's not talent all around the world. But, well,
there's always a but.
Yes, there's always a but. But what does matter, what does really matter here, is that we take the best and the most qualified in America first, if if we break ties by that matter, or even worse, if there's someone more qualified in America for a job posting, we should not be taking someone from overseas, right? That seems pretty straightforward. That's an efficient market right there. That's a decent thing to do. And one thing that I worry about is that that's not always the case here. You see these things like perm job ads. I don't know. Are you familiar with perm advertising?
Perm advertising. Explain for me and the casual listener here.
Absolutely. All right. So companies are under some very strict restrictions when they want to hire a foreign national. And one of the restrictions is that they have to make a good faith effort to select an American worker first. And this, in practice, boils down to posting an advertisement called a perm ad in newspapers, on the internet, whatever. And this, for decades and decades, back in the Elon Musk era of H-1B immigration, this worked very well. But as time has gone on and shadier actors have moved into this business, because it is riddled with shady actors, people who will, you know, who are basically coyotes just for a different population, who are promising to get you in if you pay a certain fee. Brief distraction in the studio there. These shady actors will do anything to hire a foreign national because they can pay them cheaper. And so what happens is you see perm ads posted now in tremendous numbers in, like, back catalogs of magazines nobody reads, on websites whose web address is a billion-digit long string, or they have a requirement you have to be familiar with version 14.0.1 of this internal company software, which we will then offer to our chosen applicant. Like, the ways that the system is gamed are immense, and every one of these gamings of the system takes away from the efficiency of this labor market. It prevents us from hiring the best and the most qualified American worker. Although, I do think you're completely right about the $100,000 fee. Like, that seems like a very blunt instrument to use. I would caution that they're the executive branch. The Congress stipulates all of these things, and they only have certain levers to pull, and one of those is this fee. They can jack it up, but I'm really hoping that in the future we see an actual overhaul of the H-1B system, one that expands the O-1 visa for top talent, one that becomes better at detecting fraudulent applications and attempts to prove skill that isn't actually there, one that's better at getting perm ads posted and such, and other ways for American applicants to get their foot in the door, one that's better about getting those American applicants a fair chance and a fair go. These things are important, and I would like to see an actual overhaul of that through Congress, but in the short term, this is one of the only levers the executive can pull.
Yeah, so I wanted to touch briefly on something you mentioned before, where you were talking about, you know, like, the strategy right now is to kind of bypass the permit process in order to get applicants who otherwise, you know, they could hire for cheaper. And, you know, I think that's, you know, and you say that there's kind of an issue with the efficiency in the system here, but, you know, I think the kind of permit requirement in some ways is an example of a regulatory inefficiency, you know, in the sense that, you know, sure, you want it to be meritocratic, but, you know, when anyone is deciding, you know, if they're going to hire or, you know, they're going to buy something, because labor is a commodity, and, you know, that's, we can't pretend otherwise we're treading into Karl Marx territory. You know, all this to say that, you know, when you're making consideration about whether or not you're going to spend your money on someone or something in the market, you're going to consider, you know, efficiency, quality, as compared to cost. And I think that's a totally fair thing to do, because, you know, when you're talking about AI, for example, you know, let's say you're Sam Altman, and, you know, for OpenAI, you're thinking about how you want to hire your workers. You know, especially when you're dealing with, you know, the issue of, you know, how much money are you making, because this is a venture capital operation, and very often these companies are, you know, running some interesting financial situations, and, you know, we can talk another time on the show about whether or not there's a bubble that's, you know, on the verge of bursting. But needless to say, you know, cost considerations, including overhead, are important. And, you know, sure, you want to hire the best engineers for your AI. Because if you're Sam Altman, you're competing with Google, you're competing with Meta. You have, you know, a lot to consider. And, you know, whether or not you are hiring hiring the best and brightest is among, if not the top considerations. But it's important to also consider, you know, how much do I have to pay on a per engineer or per programmer basis? That's important. And I think that, you know, generally this desire to hire people who are going to kind of, the return on investment is going to be higher for these workers. If they're foreign workers that come on H-1B visas, that's kind of the whole point. You know, we have the ability to bring the people who are going to have the highest ROI. That's going to be, that is essential for providing this service, which now increases productivity in all number of sectors in the economy, makes us all productive as a result, and basically it grows the pie for everybody. There's, you know, this kind of deals with, you know, when we're looking at especially kind of like the arguments around, you know, tariffs and protectionism, talking about domestic industry versus, you know, trade with foreign industry, considering, you know, like, you know, do we have this kind of necessary obligation to protect domestic industries or to hire domestic workers, even if there's a kind of lack of efficiency? Because sure, you might lose 20,000 jobs in, you know, like, well, we'll use over here, for example, you might lose 20,000 jobs in steelmaking, but, you know, the cost of creating steel or other durable goods that are necessary for the production of houses, for example, creates this massive diffuse benefit in which houses are cheaper to build, or, you know, apartment complexes are cheaper to build, and then, you know, that factors into rent prices later on. You know, it's the kind of ongoing...